Hello, it's Tom Slater here, editor of Spiked. We'll get into the latest episode of Last Orders in just one moment. But before we do that, I just want to say a huge thank you to everyone who's been leaving their ratings and their reviews on their podcast app. I know you've heard me say it a million times now, but it really is a brilliant way to help the show, and it takes just 30 seconds. So before you do anything else, before you listen to the rest of this show, pause, go onto your podcast app and leave us a glowing 5-star review. It really helps the show grow and reach more people. Also, thank you to everyone who has been sending in their postbag questions. We've really been enjoying them. We answer more later on in the show today. So if you want to be in with a chance of having your questions answered on the next show, just send them into lastorders@spiked-online.com. That's lastorders@spiked-online.com. Or you can message us on social media. Thanks so much. And now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spiked podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss the case for the lab leak theory, what we've learned from the lockdown files, and the lunacy of the anti-smoking lobby. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tom. Always a pleasure, never a chore.
And we're delighted to be joined today by a returning guest to the show, Matt Ridley. Matt is known to many of you, I'm sure. He's an esteemed science writer, author of many books, and most pertinent for today's discussion, he's the co-author of Viral, The Search for the Origin of COVID-19. Matt, thanks so much for coming back on the show today.
Great to be with you.
So Matt, we're going to start with the lab leak theory, which is what your book that you co-authored with Alina Chan is all about. It's back in the news, not least because of the fact that various parts of the US state have effectively come round to this particular theory. By way of a bit of context, this is about where COVID came from. Originally, it was widely presented to us that this was obviously a case of passing from animals to animals to humans. But there was still a lot of kind of circumstantial evidence piling up, something that you and your co-author and many other kind of sleuths across the internet started to look into, about this potentially going back to a lab leak, to this something that has escaped from the laboratory, potentially even being a virus that had been accelerated and manipulated in certain ways before it got out into the world. So you wrote an article for Spiked in the last couple of weeks talking about the mounting evidence for the lab leak theory. I know this is a huge topic and it's quite difficult to do it in a nutshell, I guess. But what is the case for the lab leak theory at this point? Why do you think so many different people who might previously have poo-pooed this theory are coming around to it, would you say?
Yeah, and just the people who are coming around to it, the FBI has come out and said it definitely, with moderate confidence, thinks it came from a lab. The Department of Energy, which oversees US labs, has changed its position. There were hearings in Congress yesterday, the first of many, I think, now that the Republicans control the House. And there's a weird situation now, which is that the vast majority of the public, according to polls, but according to also who comes up to me in the street and talks about it, thinks it came out of a lab. Whereas the scientific establishment secretly agrees, but in public insists that it didn't and that it can almost be ruled out. Now, that dissonance between those two views, it can't last. You know, one side has got to give. So what's the evidence? Well, it comes in two forms. First is the weakness of the evidence for it having come through a seafood market in Wuhan. Within 6 months of the discovery of SARS, it was very clear that animals were infected in the market on quite a large scale and that the early cases were food handlers and animal vendors and things like that. So none of that evidence has emerged. There is no infected animal from the market. There is no trail of early cases being a particular profession, etc., that you would expect if it came through a market. And the Chinese authorities are being very coy about the early cases. There's about 90 cases of onset in 2019 that we still haven't been given any details of. And we think that's because some of them are very early in November. We know there's a bunch of cases in November. We saw a leaked document early on that showed that, but we don't know who they were or where they worked. Possibly they were lab workers, for example. So the second part of the case for the growing strength of the case for the lab leak is the evidence about what they were doing in that lab. It's the biggest bat coronavirus research lab in the world. It was collecting viruses from a very long way away, bringing them to Wuhan, the closest relatives of this virus that were known to exist at the time the pandemic began. All nine of them were in the lab already. We know that. And the experiments that were being done in that lab were high-risk gain-of-function experiments, which in some cases led to 10,000-fold increase in the infectivity of viruses in humanized mice, that's mice with human genes. Now, if a virus at all similar to SARS-CoV-2 was being inserted into humanized mice, then you're basically training it to infect human beings. And if you're doing this at inadequate biosafety levels, as seems to have been the case, and there were a lot of problems with biosafety in that lab, but just before the pandemic, then the chances of one of those researchers developing a cough was really quite high. And the final clue is that this virus is the only SARS-like beta coronavirus ever found to this day that has a thing called a furin cleavage site in it, which makes it much more infectious, which is the reason we're having a pandemic and not a local outbreak. And a furin cleavage site, inserting a furin cleavage site into a coronavirus is a habit that virologists have got into in the last few years and is a plan that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was party to. To put one of these things into a SARS-like virus for the first time, and that plan was developed in 2018. So there's a lot of circumstantial evidence suggesting, as Robert Redfield said yesterday to Congress, the head of the US CDC at the time of the outbreak, he said he thinks it's very likely that it did happen in a lab, and he was excluded from the conversations thereon because that was an inconvenient thing for the scientific establishment to hear.
And staying with the scientific establishment, because a large part of the book that you co-authored is really about or looking at why so many sections of the scientific establishment were so keen to bat back this particular theory, and the role that effectively kind of perverse incentives, interests within their own research, their own areas of expertise might have fed into that. Again, for people who might not have been following this so closely, could you explain a little bit about that? Who are some of the players here and why were they, as I say, so keen to not let this theory be taken seriously in public discussion?
Yeah, well, at the end of January 2020, a bunch of virologists got on each other's emails and said, help, we've now seen the genome of this virus. It's got a furin cleavage site. That's rather odd. And it doesn't look like it could have got it naturally. It might have got it in a lab. So they arranged a conference call on the 1st of February 2020. Jeremy Farrar instigated it. Tony Fauci was on the call. Francis Collins, the head of the National Institutes of Health, and a bunch of virologists, about a dozen people on the call. And half of them said, I'm afraid this looks like it did come out of the lab. And the other half said, we can't accept that. It just mustn't have done. And within 4 days, within 3 days, February the 4th, 2020, they were drafting a paper saying we can rule out a lab origin. Nothing had changed. No new information had come to light explaining why this thing had a furin cleavage site. They hoped at the end of that week that the first pangolin viruses might bail them out because there was suspicion that these things might have a furin cleavage site. They don't. So they didn't help. But nonetheless, they went ahead and published that paper, which influenced a lot of people, including me at the time. I was going around telling colleagues in the House of Lords, no, no, you can rule out a lab leak. There's this very important paper in Nature Medicine that says so. I later discovered that that paper was very flimsy in its argument and highly conflicted in its vested interests because the people writing it were essentially doing gain-of-function research on viruses themselves. Some of them were collaborating with the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and they would be very uncomfortable if it came out that some of their work had indeed led to a lab leak. So their funding, their reputation was at stake. That, you know, was a real crisis for them. Now, what should have happened is that senior scientists like Anthony Fauci and Francis Collins should have said, nonetheless, we have to investigate and we have to tell the world that this is a possibility. Because if we find out that it did happen, we can explain that we're going to take measures to stop it happening again, and we can regain the trust of the public in science quite quickly, and the damage will be limited to a small corner of virology. Instead of which, by saying no for 2 or 3 years and publishing papers that say they had dispositive evidence of the market when they show no such thing, and monstering people on social media and in the media, and getting Facebook to ban any conversation about the lab leak and calling it a conspiracy theory and all this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They now, the result of that is that the damage to the reputation of science is going to infect the whole of science now, and the public is going to lose trust in all of science, which is a terrible pity in my view.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring Chris in just one moment, but if I just might ask one more question. You mentioned the censorship there. So many of the social media firms taking their lead seemingly from the US government and others suppressed this story, flagged it as misinformation, downvoted it, pushed it down the algorithm, etc. And again, it became the way in which this story went from, as you say, being a kind of racist conspiracy theory to a plausible theory to something which on the balance of probabilities, a lot of people think could actually have happened in terms of officialdom. Surely that's a lesson in why you can't suppress scientific debate, particularly at a time of such huge consequence. Do you think we'll learn the lessons of that? Because it still feels like on many other issues, we're presented with a conclusion that we're encouraged not to challenge when it comes to climate or other issues. Do you think we will learn lessons from this?
Well, I fear that as the lockdown story, which we're going to get onto, shows, and as the climate debate shows, there is an increasing tendency in the scientific and political establishment to have policy-based evidence-making rather than evidence-based policy-making. In other words, you start with your conclusion and try and buttress it with evidence that might support it rather than seeing where the evidence leads you. I would like to think that this will be a wake-up call to the increasingly politicized scientific establishment about the use of the science to try and persuade people rather than try and understand the world in a transparent and open-minded way. But I have my doubts. I mean, I had a conversation yesterday with a very senior retired scientist who actually has been quite vocal about the risks of biotechnology throughout much of his career. But I said, you must be feeling rather justified. And he said, no, it's vital that we don't find out. And I said, what do you mean? Surely you mean do? And he said, no, don't, because it would be really upsetting to international relations with China. And I said, would you say the same about an airline crash or a nuclear meltdown? Would you say it's vital that we don't find out? Mm-hmm. Of course not. You'd say it's vital that we do find out. And he said, well, we need to take measures to make it safer anyway. And I said, yeah, but we're not doing so. A dozen biosafety level 4 labs have opened since the pandemic began, mostly in Asia. This gain of function research is accelerating. It's not decelerating at all in the wake of the pandemic. So I'm not convinced lessons are being learned yet.
And Chris, where are you on the whole lab leak debate? Or have you got any questions for Matt here?
Well, I've really, ever since I found out that Wuhan did have an Institute of Virology, which had the biggest collection of bat coronaviruses in the world, I've always kind of assumed that the two things might be linked. And I read some of that stuff, and I saw what seemed to me quite a good Channel 4 documentary about this a while ago, which I'm sure there are alternative views there, but it seemed pretty cut and dry to me, really. And I don't really, and I know people who believe in conspiracy theories always deny that the thing they believe is a conspiracy theory, but this genuinely doesn't seem to fit the bill of a conspiracy theory. It was an accident, right? The bioweapon theory would be a conspiracy theory. The only conspiratorial part of this, I suppose, is that the Chinese Communist Party would try and cover it up. But that doesn't require a huge leap of imagination to believe. So, how much it really matters, I mean, beyond, quite important things like not letting something like this happen again. I don't know. I suppose my question for Matt is, why are they doing all this gain-of-function research? It sounds very risky and reckless to me.
It's a really good question. And the answer is, I think, just getting carried away with brilliant techniques that lead to startling results that get published in Nature and Science. In other words, when Ralph Baric at North Carolina invented the reverse genetic system for assembling viruses from, as it were, the computer, but to the recipe of a natural virus, but altering them in interesting ways in order to test out what they were like. The money that was sloshing around post-SARS, some of it went to this work and said, oh, could this be a way of finding the next pandemic virus? testing viruses we find in the wild and seeing how dangerous they are by mixing and matching their genes. And that became a sort of article of faith in among a group of scientists led by Peter Daszak, who was funneling US money to China for this work, led by the Wuhan Institute of Virology and Xi Zhengli's lab in particular. And there were other scientists who were saying, this is not the best way to predict or prevent a pandemic. You're looking for a needle in a haystack to try and find the next virus that's going to cause a pandemic anyway. And you might actually cause one in doing this work. You're looking for a gas leak with a lighted match, as someone put it. There was a live debate saying, are we really sure this is wise stuff to do? The rest of us didn't even know it was going on. And what's, I think, rather remarkable, and Chris might find this ironic, he might take the other side of the view on this, but is that now I'm having debates with virologists who say, don't you dare call for more regulation of virology labs. There's tons of regulation anyway. We should be the ones deciding which experiments we do. I mean, I'm a libertarian, but I don't go quite that far.
Yeah, it's like these people have never seen a disaster movie. You know, I mean, this is exactly how they start with scientists messing around, making things more dangerous, just kind of because they can, really.
Well, I've always been a huge critic of the fact that Hollywood makes every scientist out to be Frankenstein, and, you know, because it just ain't true. Most scientists are doing wonderful things and inventing vaccines and saving lives and all that kind of thing. And it's just so annoying that one group of scientists have gone off and proved these damned Hollywood scriptwriters right.
Yeah.
So let's turn to how the British government responded to this virus. In the last couple of weeks, we have all been poring over the lockdown files. So these are is the reporting of the Daily Telegraph in partnership with Isabel Oakeshott over essentially a trove of leaked WhatsApp messages, primarily of Matt Hancock, the former health secretary, Isabel Oakeshott, the journalist, had collaborated with Matt Hancock on his pandemic diaries, his kind of pandemic memoir, and being a lockdown skeptic, happened to decide that these were in the public interest, as of course they are. So over recent weeks, the Telegraph has been reporting on, essentially giving us the inside track of how these decisions were being made, how they were being discussed inside government. There's been revelations about the way in which you had senior civil servants almost laughing about people who were being kept in the hotel's quarantine. There's been quite eye-opening, I think, insight into how you might have the scientific advisors saying one thing, but then for political reasons, ministers saying another. Chris Whitty wanting to cut down isolation periods. Matt Hancock saying no, because we don't want people to think that we've got it wrong previously. Matt, there's so much to talk about, but is there anything in particular that struck you about these lockdown files and what they've revealed?
First of all, as we've seen today, there is stuff about the lab leak and the civil servants insisting Matt Hancock take out some of the speculation about a lab leak from his book, Lest to Defend the Chinese Government. Well, I'm not entirely surprised by that, but I am still pretty shocked by it. But the other thing that strikes me as emerging from it, and I'm not sure I approve of Isabel Oakeshott leaking this stuff in at some level, but I'm jolly interested in it when I read it. The other thing that strikes me is the degree of flimsiness of the data behind the decisions that were taken, particularly when it comes to the second lockdown and then the threat of the Omicron lockdown at the end of 2021. I was quite active in arguing in Parliament that the data wasn't there, that the models showing vast increases in the number of cases and deaths were wildly overstated, were based on ridiculous assumptions, and that the evidence, as far as I could see it, was not there to back up these kind of decisions. And I thought, well, at least there's a grown-up in number 10 who's crunching the numbers. And, you know, I keep being told by the ministers that, no, we know what we're doing. Well, it turns out all they were basing it on were these same flimsy models and a few articles in the newspaper that they were passing to each other by WhatsApp. So it really has sort of pulled the veil away from the little man behind the curtain at the Wizard of Oz.
Mm. And Chris, what have you made of the lockdown file so far?
Quite good fun, aren't they? I mean, Hancock is an incredible idiot for letting Isabel Oakeshott have him in the first place. It's not like she's some sort of ally of his anyway. She's a well-known anti-lockdown journalist who has kind of stabbed people in the back before to get a story, and fair enough, you know, she wants to get a story. So I'm it's just staggering. I think that Hancock gave her 100,000 these private messages. The messages themselves, I mean, I agree with Matt. I mean, it just once again reminds you that no one really knows what they're doing in this world. Everybody's winging it, and these people don't know much better than the average man in the street. Somebody yesterday said that it was like a university WhatsApp group, like just the biggest university WhatsApp group. And it is really, some of it is really very funny. For some of it's quite concerning, but not shocking in the sense that it's genuinely surprising. I mean, the main thing I think these messages show is that a lot of people, especially Matt Hancock and the civil servant Simon Case, were power-crazed very quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, they went to their head. Absolute power, absolutely corrupted. And I think we kind of knew that. You know, I kind of worked that out after a three-week lockdown turned into a three-and-a-half-month lockdown, and the government was busily talking about whether a Scotch egg consists of a significantly substantial meal to justify mm-hmm. having a pint with it. You know, I mean, it brings it all back, doesn't it? I kind of thought we stopped talking about COVID, and, you know, just in this podcast, we talked about nothing else. And, it brings it all back. It reminds you of all the many absurdities and the bells and whistles that are attached to these policies, how a lot of it was being made up on the hoof. But, you know, mainly this, whenever there was a kind of a decision to be made, they would go for the most draconian one. And this, some people have come out okay from it. I personally think Boris Johnson's come out quite well from it. Just the fact that he was even in the group chatting to people surprised me, to be honest. I thought he'd just be getting drunk or something, or writing his book about writing his book about Shakespeare. But no, he's in there asking some reasonably sensible questions. He clearly, by the time we get to summer of 2020, is erring towards not locking down again. And I know he's been criticised for having like Carl Hennigan come in one occasion. But it's not like Carl Hennigan is David Icke or something. You know, he's like a professor of evidence-based medicine at Oxford University, which I think he got quite a few things wrong during the pandemic, but who didn't? So I think he came across okay. I think Simon Case, who I'd never really heard of, comes across terribly. I mean, one of the messages, which I think sums up the whole problem, is between him and Hancock. Well, there's one about quarantining people where they're just giggling about it, right? They're taking so much glee from the fact that these people are going to come out of first-class aeroplanes and be put into some shoebox in the Premier Inn.
Hilarious was his
hilarious, response, exactly, yeah. While all the time, you know, Hancock is groping his girlfriend and they're having numerous kind of vomit-soaked parties in number 10. But no, the one that, if anything, annoyed me even more was Simon Case. This is in January 2021, so we're in under total lockdown, and still Hancock is not happy with the amount of compliance for some reason. And they're thinking, well, what more can we do given the country's in lockdown? And Simon Case says, well, the only thing left is really making people wear masks everywhere. And the good thing about that is it's effectively cost-free. Now, I always suspected that the reason that the government stuck with the masks, even when they'd abandoned everything else, and when Plan B came in late 2021, it was mainly just mask wearing. And I understand that wearing a mask is kind of at the more liberal end of these draconian restrictions. But the idea that it's cost-free only makes sense in terms of like government revenue. It only makes sense insofar as you're not giving people furlough money and cash grants. It's not cost-free in terms of like welfare economics. It's, you know, it's anything from annoying to really very restrictive. You know, if somebody who's trying to lip read would be at the hard end of that. But a lot of people, especially if you've got to wear them all day long, it's really unpleasant. And these people just go, well, we want to do something else. We don't really need to do anything else, but if we want to do something else, we could extend this mask wearing because it doesn't cost us any money. That's what little regard they had for people's liberty.
Managing the politics of it as well, just, you know, we need to do something, we need to go further, let's go with this. No thought about the consequences necessarily.
Yeah, and also we can't relax this thing that we should never have brought in because we'll look bad. It will look inconsistent.
That was probably one of the most shocking things to me, was that, you know, we can't liberalise because it will look like we've been caught out or something.
They got advice that the 14-day self-isolation period was too long and it doesn't really need to be more than 5 days. And Hancock's going, well, that's a big change. People are going to think we didn't know what we were doing in the first place. And I think they compromised, made it 7 days or something, you know, but they were not following the science at that point.
No, not in the slightest. And you get that sense of having to, again, constantly having to manage the message. And obviously, these leaks have been pretty devastating for Matt Hancock. They have painted him in a terrible light, made him look like obsessed with how things looked rather than the actual science and so on, making decisions in a very arbitrary fashion. You know, a junior minister is trying to urge him to loosen up the rules on care homes, and then eventually just says, okay, you win. Like, this is the sort of thinking that was going in to how we deal with people's civil liberties. And I always think it is worth remembering that even if people supported the lockdown, I think people should have been very concerned about the way in which it was done, because it was law being made at the strike of the pen of the health secretary. And that health secretary was one Matt Hancock. So if you think Matt Hancock is a questionable figure, shall we say, you should be certainly concerned that he was effectively ruling by decree under the Public Health Act through large parts of the pandemic.
Yeah. Well, one of the messages just shows him saying that we basically decided we're not going to do anything on schools until September. This is in June, right? When he says not do anything with schools, he means keep them closed. Keep them closed throughout June, throughout July. And for a lot of people, quite rightly, that was the biggest issue with the whole lockdown, is that they couldn't send their kids to school, so they had to homeschool them, which people aren't very good at doing. Their kids were unhappy, and they couldn't do any work. The parents couldn't do any work, so we're homeschooling the kids and looking after them. And this decision just to keep them closed until September was just made in an unbelievably flippant way, just as if, well, okay, that's just off the table. We're not even going to discuss that. And yeah, I think we maybe suspected this was how it was, and it's nice to, it has to be said, these messages have been cherry-picked. There's been a lot of messages there, and there might be some that, you know, the Telegraph is not publishing, which, put these people in the better light. But I don't think there's anything that can kind of wash away the stain of the messages that have been published.
Can I just add one thing that also shocked me hugely? Was the only mention that we've seen so far of Sweden was Matt Hancock saying, effing Sweden, will you stop letting people try and tell me about Sweden? Well, the data's in. I mean, there's another set of data just this week on excess deaths comparing different countries. And yeah, you have to do quite sophisticated statistical analysis to correct for demography and various trends in different countries and so on. But however you cook it, Sweden comes out either the best country in the entire sample or the second best to Denmark as the country with the lowest number of excess deaths over the period of the pandemic. And Johan Anderberg's brilliant book on this topic, the inside story of how Sweden resisted the herd, is, I think, essential reading. And even this week, I heard Michael Gove arguing with Julia Hartley Brewer, saying, no, Sweden did lock down. No, it jolly well did not. You know, so the Swedish lesson is really important to be learned. And the fact that they were so flippant about it, using a four-letter word, is not a good sign, in my view.
Chris, anything to add on Sweden before we move on? I know you were in the trenches on that particular question for many months over the course of the pandemic.
Well, all I would say is every time we tried to act like Sweden, people didn't behave themselves at all sensibly, possibly less responsibly than the Swedish did, and cases went through the roof and the hospitals filled up. So I think we probably need to accept there are some intrinsic differences between Sweden and the UK that mean that, you know, a one-size policy doesn't necessarily fit all.
Well, let's move on, Chris, to a story that you've picked out to talk about, which is part of what feels like a recurring theme on this podcast, which is public health bodies acting in a very strange way, even when basically big tobacco does something relatively good. Last month, in the last episode, we were talking about them getting very upset about tobacco companies funding vaccines, I believe. And in this case, it's about tobacco companies contributing to the aid efforts in Turkey and that putting a lot of noses out of joint in the kind of public health activist sphere. Do you want to tell us a bit more about this?
Yeah, this is what I call the are we the baddies syndrome in public health, in which they oppose people doing manifest good because it hurts their feelings, basically. So the most recent example of this is Philip Morris, the tobacco company in Turkey, which has a big operation in Turkey, has a big factory, a lot of employees. They offered a $1.8 million donation to, I think it's the Turkish government, for humanitarian aid and long-term recovery assistance, which you would think is absolutely, you know, fine and indeed laudable. But the The Turkish Coalition on Tobacco or Health to the European Network for Smoking and Tobacco Prevention, quite a mouthful that, as activist groups go. Anyway, an anti-smoking group said this was outrageous and demanded that the government turn away this money and said it was a form of sort of corporate lobbying in some sense, and it was a chance for the tobacco company to make itself look respectable by doing something nice. But I mean, you know, if you do something nice, I guess people will like you a little bit more. I don't think it's going to change many people's, you know, views of cigarettes or even Philip Morris. But, you know, the idea that the government should turn down money after a massive disaster like that just because of who it comes from strikes me as fairly obscene. And this is just one in a number of examples like this. So, yeah, last episode we talked about the WHO effectively cancelling an effective and cheap COVID vaccine just because Philip Morris owned a fifth of the company that created it. During the pandemic, there were numerous examples like a British public health kind of academic activist group were moaning about BrewDog, whose pubs were closed because it was locked down. They were complaining that BrewDog was opening these pubs and letting the government use them as vaccination centres. They thought this was terrible. Dr. Asim Malhotra, you may recall, kicked off because Krispy Kreme Donuts donated 1,500 donuts to staff at Barnet Hospital, which their staff were delighted at, but he said it was an absolute disgrace. Numerous other examples of this, Coca-Cola and companies such as that. So often just giving money, just donating money to healthcare workers. There was another tobacco industry one, was one of the tobacco companies in Greece offered some ventilators during the height of the pandemic, which, you know, of course, there was a huge shortage of those. Food companies like Kraft donating ultra-processed food, and this is a new villain in public health, ultra-processed food. So they were offering macaroni, cheese, and peanut butter to people in America. This apparently was appalling. Another company were offering noodles. And so you can get more and more of this because you have these blinkered fanatics who just see themselves, you know, they see themselves as sort of David against a corporate Goliath. And anything that, you know, these industries do that, you know, looks nice because it actually is nice, they're against it. And they would rather see people not get ventilators and not get food and not get aid rather than, as they see it, these industries have a little bit of, good coverage. The irony is that we'd never hear about any of these donations, any of this charity, if it weren't for the groups complaining about it. You know, these are just basically gifts that are given to government. Whether the companies issue a press release or not, I don't know. Probably not most of the time.
It's not going to get much pickup, that press release.
It never gets any pickup.
Hooray for Philip Morris or whatever.
The only pickup is when, you know, in the case of this earthquake story, you know, you get a headline like "Activist Fume at Tobacco Industry for Donating to Earthquake Hit to Turkey." So it's totally self-defeating. They're the only people who are shining a light on this and giving them this good coverage, effectively, are the people who are dead against them and don't think they should be helping in the first place.
Matt, what do you make of all this?
Well, I think we're going to end up in a perverse situation where every company on the planet, or rather every company in Turkey, is under pressure to donate some of their hard-earned profits to help earthquake victims, except the tobacco companies, which can sail off into the sunset and hand the money out to their shareholders instead. It's a bit like what's happening in climate change, where, you know, we mustn't deal with oil companies. So the rest of the economy is going to have to grapple with the expensive measures of, you know, inventing and developing and rolling out technologies that involve low carbon energy. But the oil companies get off scot-free. There's an argument, which is very well made by people like Miles Allen, the professor of climate at Oxford, that actually, you know, here's a huge industry called the oil industry, which knows what it's doing. It's pretty good at stuff. Why don't we make it develop carbon capture technologies or something, rather than say, sorry, we're not going to deal with them? Because if we say that, they've just, you know, they've got off scot-free. They're not having to contribute to solving the problem. As I say, they can make more profits. So there's a sort of weird, and actually you saw that in the 90s when the tobacco companies were shunned by every right-on person. And as a result, they became the most profitable stocks and shares on the market.
And I suppose I should make clear, we're not getting money from Philip Morris, but I'm 100% open to it. If any of them are listening, we're giving you a lot of free advertising, particularly in this episode, but in recent weeks. So do get in touch.
Well, the advertising, so tobacco advertising ban's another example, right? They just stopped them spending a huge amount of money, and so they just had made more money.
So should we go on to the postbag section, our questions from our listeners?
Yes, the postbag section, sponsored by Marlboro Lights.
Postbag, postbag, postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
So we've got a question here which touched on a lot of what we've been talking about already, actually. It's from Morgan Evans, who says, my question is, that why do journalists give politicians such an easy time? He lists a couple of issues here: sugar tax, advertising bans, minimum pricing on alcohol, net zero. They seem to allow them to tell lies without ever really holding their toes to the fire. So, Matt, what do you think about that? Why are journalists so willing to just sort of go along with what is presented to them as the consensus on some of these issues?
Yeah, it's bizarrely one-sided. I mean, you'd never let a Tory politician on the Today programme get away with half a sentence, let alone a major fib. But the Extinction Rebellion spokesman is allowed to say ridiculous things like a billion people are going to starve to death in the next 10 years. And there's not even a sort of, hang on, I can't believe that figure's right. There's a sort of, oh, thank you for talking to us. So there's the media is both too aggressive and too sycophantic at the same time. It's just to different people. And that's where its bias really shows, in my view.
What do you think, Chris?
I think it's a combination of sort of a halo effect from the charities like Cancer Research, a very well-respected charity, but the fact that it's very well-respected means it can get away with saying almost anything, really. And, you know, Action on Smoking Health, well, they're against smoking, so they must be good, and the Alcohol Health Alliance are against, you know, they're against things that are bad, right? So they must be the good guys. And similarly with, you know, there's a lot of activist academics who, you know, spout a lot of nonsense, really, and their research is often very poor, but they are professors or doctors, at least, and they have, you know, track records. So they tend to be trusted, whereas because it's always portrayed as being the nice paternalistic groups versus industry, as opposed to versus the consumer, which is what it really is in practice, people don't really trust the industry. I don't trust industry in general, but they particularly don't trust industries that make products that occasionally kill people, and so the balance is never really there. And no journalist ever wants to find out in a few years' time that they were taken for a ride by some corporate lobbyist or something. So they will tend to side with the supposed good guys on these issues. And the other thing is the media is generally biased towards reporting scary stuff, right? And a lot of what these campaign groups come up with is, if you don't do something about this, then, you know, 60% of people are going to be obese in the next 5 years. And so even though the models that such predictions are based on, we had a load of them a few days ago when it was International Obesity Day or World Obesity Day or whatever it was, a huge amount of skepticism is required, really, when dealing with any kind of public health model. So I hope people over the last few years would have seen that in particular. But, you know, it's a scary number. And it sells newspapers, whereas someone like me say, actually, this isn't a big deal, and the economic cost of obesity are negligible, is not really much of a story, you know?
I suppose there's also just the blending between journalists in these areas and activists. I mean, in certain cases, the distinction seems to not be there whatsoever. If you think about some of the people, to name names, people like Justin Rowlatt at the BBC, who's their climate editor or climate correspondent, I can't remember his exact title. I mean, for all intents and purposes, he is an environmentalist. I mean, you see that in the tenor of his questioning.
Roger Black before him, I think.
Exactly. Yeah, good old Roger Harabin.
There's a guy in The Guardian, Rob Davis, is it? Who's, I mean, more or less openly just an anti-gambling campaigner who happens to work for a newspaper.
I think in Justin Rowlatt's case, his sister is in Extinction Rebellion. I mean, there's a certain point in which conflict of interest doesn't really cover what we're talking about here, but they don't see it. I think that's one of the striking things. So complete is the groupthink.
I've often noticed that science reporters see their duty as to faithfully and accurately and sycophantically report what scientists say, whereas business reporters or political reporters see it as their job to challenge their sources. And you just don't find a reporter on Science or Nature or Scientific American or a science journalist in the newspaper who sees it as his job to challenge a scientist ever. And the scientists, by the way, are deeply shocked if you ever do it to them because they're expecting an easy ride.
There is, very quickly, one final point, which is a lot of journalists themselves are nanny statists, authoritarians, call it what you will. But, you know, go back to COVID one more time. Just keep thinking. I keep thinking about those press conferences where Beth Rigby and Robert Peston every single day are going like, "Why aren't you locking her down harder? Why are you still allowing this to be done?" So I think there is a bias amongst these people for whatever reason towards more government intervention.
We've got a final question here, which I'm going to throw in, even though it's got nothing to do with anything that we've talked about previously. But from a listener asking, how do we fight back against the academy and the cultural gatekeepers who are ushering in these new forms of speech, talking about various universities using bizarre non-gendered language, talking about a particular example here of the University of Southern California trying to usher in what it sees as anti-racist language, not using words like field and field house and athletics field because of some tenuous connection to slavery or something like this. Matt, is this something that you've noted? Is this important? Is this something that we should concern ourselves about? What's going on there, do you think?
Well, even my old field of biology has been in some university has said, right, we're not going to use the word male and female for animals anymore. Well, that's going to be really tricky. the birthing parent killer whale is going in one direction and the non-birthing parent killer whale is going in the other direction. I expected more rebellion in academia against this kind of stuff by now. I'm disappointed that there hasn't been more. I get hints that the younger generation of students know this is nonsense and are slightly more sensible than the ones who are 5 years older than them. Just like, we thought the hippies were a bit silly because they were 5 years older than us. So I'm hopeful that tanker will start to turn. You're seeing all sorts of bright people start initiatives to push back on various things, but it's been a long time coming.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any optimism on this front, Chris?
A little bit. Insofar as some of this stuff is obviously crazy and everyone can see it's crazy and people just intimidated into pretending it isn't for the time being, but it can't persist. And I totally agree with Matt, it's kind of a generational thing and it's a fashion really that will go out of fashion, I would imagine, but probably leave a bit of a, still leave a scar, I think. Some of this stuff I imagine is going to cling on. I'm starting to wonder with this whole, with the Roald Dahl thing and everything, I'm starting to wonder whether a lot of this isn't just publicity. Maybe I should have realised this earlier on, but it seems to me there's a lot of PR involved in this. They're not going to do this thing with Roald Dahl, are they? And then straight afterwards, the people who published James Bond say, we're going to clean up that. Mm. I bet they don't do that either. It just gives a lot of publicity. It's marketing, right? I think a lot of it is. And maybe even at the universities there's an element of that too.
I fear they believe it more than we realise.
Maybe you should announce that you're gonna retrospectively change your language on all the Spiked articles. or the IEA reports. We could say we're gonna republish Hayek, but we're more culturally sensitive way.
That's a brilliant idea.
You finally break libertarianism through to the woke.
Well, we won't call it the Road to Serfdom because it's got slavery connections, so we'll have to call it something else. We'll just call it the Road.
Well, on that note, let's end it. Matt, Chris, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.